Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the October 10, 2017 edition of Ask a Leader. Today on the show, political commentator and author Charles Sykes and I will chart the political Venn diagram, the left vis-a-vis the right, and what we talk about is brand new book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, published by St. Martin's Press. Then, in the second segment, climate scientist and blogger Shahir Masri will return to finish what we started a couple weeks ago about climate science. Earth, that's spelled with two A's, Bill McKibben's essential notion toward rethinking the disposition of our planet that he has submitted to us. Also, we'll talk about the spike in post-disaster payouts and the ubiquitous plastic stuff. Let's consider our choices. We'll be right back after a short station break. Welcome back to the show. My first guest is Charles Sykes, political commentator and author, out with a new book entitled How the Right Lost Its Mind, published by St. Martin's Press. Charles Sykes, a self-described contrarian conservative, is the author of 8 books on current affairs and education, including Fail You, A Nation of Victims, and Prof Scam. He has written for the Wall Street Journal and Time.com. You may have read his front page or op-ed pieces in the New York Times, including the one this last Sunday entitled NRA and GOP Together Forever. He is also the editor of Right Wisconsin. Charles Sykes hung up the mic at his conservative talk show on WTMJ in Milwaukee last December. Among others was his crowning achievement with the 2010 honor flight of World War II veterans. Charles Sykes has taken his critiques of Donald Trump to MSNBC, CNN, and WNYC's Indivisible. He remains very active on social media. I will tell you, right up until probably minutes ago, the last I checked was about 40 minutes ago. He completed his Bachelor's of Arts in English at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. He comes to us today from San Francisco while on his book tour for How the Right Lost Its Mind. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Charles Sykes.
Thank you.
Or should I?
With you.
Thank you. Or should I say, welcome to California wildfires? You've got them up there, and we've got them down here. And welcome to states' rights, Jerry Brown style.
Yes, you're learning to love federalism, I understand.
Oh, right. Oh, it's an existential sort of prerogative. So I must congratulate you on your latest book, How the Right Lost Its Mind. And just between you and me, though, and since you've been in so many mediums, just as a little opener, is which medium do you prefer? The television, the radio, newspaper, books? What is it? Or is it a sort of like you like them all?
Well, they're all so different. You know, I suppose I started off as a writer, and I still like having written more than anything else. So I would say I like that the most. Although, you know, the kind of conversation that we're about to have,
yes.
We're about to have, also, you know, I enjoy being able to get more in depth and to be able to have an exchange of views. So it's like asking me to pick among my, you know, who's my favorite kid, who's my
right.
favorite child. But I would say that writing is still my first love.
Well, it's in your affable way. I've seen how you've been doing radio. I'm not as much into the television bit, so I can't speak for that. But with how you've handled radio, I can see why all these mediums make it difficult, a Solomon's choice of sorts. Well, I must congratulate you, as I said, with topical books like yours, Charles Sykes, the difficulty you must have in stopping writing and then hitting the send button to your publisher.
Oh, particularly with this one, you know, because this I had to start writing, you know, very shortly after the election, knowing it wasn't going to be coming out until the fall. So was working on this throughout the first 100 days of the administration and then passed. And really, as you well know,
yes.
almost on a daily basis, something happens that I think, well, I wish I would have included that, or I wish I would have added that, or this is relevant to what I would have said. But ultimately, you know, when it comes to writing a book, there is that moment you press send and it's done and you have to send it out into the world. What I'm hoping to have done is to at least have created an explanation and a framework for people to be able to understand, you know, this changing environment. So I'm not able to keep up with every breaking tweet from the president or news development, but at least put it into some sort of a context, you know, where perhaps we came from.
Well, speaking then of framework, I'd really look forward to you taking this opportunity to unpackage, list for us all those values that you consider to be, and I quote you, central to the conservative tradition, as a way of answering the question, what mind did the right lose?
Well, you know, this is a difficult question because there are so many different aspects of
right.
the conservative tradition. And I think one of the things that we found out was that there were various factions. And to a certain extent, the conservative movement was a mess. You had your libertarian conservatives, you had authoritarian conservatives, you had conservatives that were primarily interested in, you know, in pushing economic issues versus social issues. But I do think there was at one time this consensus over what was described as ordered liberty, this belief in things like, you know, for example, individual freedom, respect for the Constitution, respect for free markets, personal responsibility, traditional values, maybe even occasionally civility itself, all of the things that I think have been rejected by the conservative movement as it becomes more Trumpian.
Would you say also that democratic values are conservative values? And because this, I mean, I'm looking at the Venn diagram. I'm really unabashedly
yes.
looking at that. But I didn't see democratic with the small d in what your discussion was in the book.
Well, yes, democratic norms and values are crucial. And by the way, you know, in that Venn diagram between liberals and conservatives, which I'm really fascinated by, because I don't think there's a lot of overlap right now between left and right, but where there is an overlap, it's very important. And democratic values would be in there. Of course, then the question is, what do we mean by democratic values, small d? Are we talking about raw rule by the majority? Are we talking about the kind of populism that Donald Trump and Steve Bannon are pushing out, because they will often claim that many of their positions are, you know, small d democracy. So I think that there's a balance there, and I think this is one of the things that conservatives over the years had tried to balance out: the respect for democracy, but also respect for the limitations of democracy. You know, the limitations that are written into the Constitution, limitations that I think we appreciate more every day now that we see what's happening in Washington.
Well, I guess because of how severely separated the right and left are on the Venn diagram in October 2017, and because of what you were talking about, the right's mind, I'm going to spend a little bit of time with you today to talk about pre-Steve Bannon kind of, let's say, advising. I mean, he's been obviously involved in politics for a while and been a force to reckon with, but I want to go pre-Steve Bannon in terms of conservatism. So when we look at conservative thought, and I want you to talk about the extent to which there's intellectual honesty in conservative thinking, and along with that, I always think of investigative reporting, rigorous reporting, finding out what's the real story, probing deeply. So where are examples of conservative rigor in investigating what's happening?
Well, I'm not sure I fully understand it. I mean, I do think that there have been, you know, are you asking about conservative journalists, conservative journalism?
Right. And
well,
the discourse.
I mean, I do think that some of the work done by publications like the Weekly Standard have really done good work, particularly when it comes to some issues of foreign affairs. But I do think there's also the need to separate that when you're talking about, you know, intellectual consistency and rigor, to understand that I think there may have been a disconnect between the conservative intellectual tradition and the conservative movement. And one of the things that we discovered is that the conservative intellectual tradition, I think, was a much thinner layer over what the conservative movement had become. And so there may seem to be some significant contradictions there that I think are being exposed now in the current era.
And you do talk about William F. Buckley's contributions, including his contribution that he walked back some of his civil rights disposition.
Yes, well, this is one of the areas where I do think we need to have some honest discussion because, you know, William F. Buckley Jr. is, I think, if you go back to the founding of the modern conservative movement, he is the pivotal figure in so many ways. And one of the things that National Review and Buckley did in the 1950s was to take a very, very pro-Southern, what appeared to be a pro-segregationist stand. And I think that unfortunately tainted the conservative movement for some time. In 1957, most Republicans in the United States Senate voted for the Civil Rights Bill of that time. By 1964, conservatives were in opposition to the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, and Barry Goldwater voted against it. Then, of course, 4 years later, you saw Richard Nixon launching the Southern Strategy. And I do think that shaped the Republican Party and the conservative movement's attitude towards race in ways that a lot of conservatives were reluctant to acknowledge openly for a very long time.
And that's the mind I really want to have us think about, because that seeded so many consequential policies and attitudes. And when you said it was unfortunate what William F. Buckley did, but, you know, if I were in a lesser privileged political class, I would say unfortunate was really consequential. And I think it's important that conservative intellectuals own it more than just an unfortunate, but a rather consequential position to take.
Yeah, and perhaps more consequential than a lot of people on the right had realized. Now, let me give you the other side of this story, because this is important. And I know that a lot of people don't like to hear this other part of it. Because, you know, and I want to fast forward now to what happened in 2016, where you saw the rise of the alt-right.
Right.
And you had a presidential candidate who was engaging in more than just dog whistles. You know, he's retweeting white supremacist websites and engaging in some of the most racially charged rhetoric that we've seen, you know, at that level in American politics.
Yes.
In a very, very long time. And a lot of people on both the right and the left looked at this and said, you know, look, this is racist. But you had a large portion of the electorate that obviously sort of shrugged. It didn't register with them. Now, why was that? Well, one of the problems was, I think, that over the last 20 or 30 years, there has been this reflexive, the accusation that all Republicans and all conservatives are racist. And the term racist was thrown around so much. George Bush was racist. George Bush Jr. was racist. Mitt Romney was racist. John McCain was racist. Everybody's racist. To a certain point, it was like crying wolf, because at a certain point, that word, which was so powerful in the 1960s, lost a lot of its power. Among conservatives, what happened was they would just basically roll their eyes and say, well, that's what they always say. So when the real thing came along, which it did last year, in very dramatic, ways, the critics had used up their ammunition, and I think that a lot of people in the Republican Party had become numb to the reality that, hey, you know what? There is racism, and there are bigots in our midst, and we ought to do something about it. So you did have that 20 or 30 year tradition of overstating. Now, as I make it clear in the book, that does not let conservatives or Republicans off the hook. They ignored the racists. They ignored the bigots in their midst. They ignored the birther conspiracy theories. They did not push back. So, and that is a fundamental moral failing. So I don't know how many Republicans or conservatives are actual racists. But I will say, and I do say in the book, that it's undeniable that too many Republicans had become comfortable with tolerating it, with looking the other way. Otherwise, you would not have had Donald Trump as the nominee of the Republican Party. There's no way around that.
Well, do you think that conservatives would have allowed for the, I'm going to say the underprivileged class, people that have been vulnerable in terms of in the political process, that were they to say white privilege and use that label? Because that I think speaks to everybody along the political spectrum who hasn't stepped up and talked against any micro or macro aggression. Do you think that white privilege would have been more acceptable for the conservatives?
Well, I don't know that they would have articulated it that way. You know, I mean, you know, part of it is the whole concept of white privilege was raised at a time when Donald Trump was effectively tapping into the fact that you had a lot of the white working class that felt that they were the ones who were being ignored, okay. that they were, in fact, the underprivileged, that they had dropped off the radar screen. And so when Donald Trump said, you know, I'm going to talk about your grievances, your resentments, your problems, he was actually talking to a constituency that did not feel that they were privileged at all. They felt that they had been marginalized. And this was something that both the Democrats and the Republicans, I think, missed until 2016.
Well, it's a much larger topic, and I have many more to cover, so I'm going to just leave it at that for now. But for those of you who are just joining us, my guest is political commentator and author Charles Sykes about his new book, How the Right Lost Its Mind. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Well, quickly, the fairness doctrine was very consequential. It spawned some pretty pernicious media enterprises on radio and television. I think that was the door that got kicked open for good. That was a very consequential measure to undo.
Yeah, there's no question about it, and it changed the media landscape dramatically. One of the things that I think is so interesting, and I had not fully realized until I researched, was doing the research for the book, is that there was no real conservative talk radio during the Reagan era.
No, there was none.
During the period in which conservatives look back and think of that as their golden era, there was not that much of a conservative media infrastructure. So it really raises the question, did that help or hurt back then? But yeah, in the late 1980s, when the Fairness Doctrine was repealed.
1987,
It opened the door for the rise of conservative talk radio and probably resurrected the AM radio dial. and that brought on both good things and bad things. And, you know, it took a dying medium, and it injected it with a great deal of energy. And obviously, there was a huge market for that. And this, again, is part of my story, because, of course, I was one of the beneficiaries of this as a conservative talk show host.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning, I believe that this was a positive development because it allowed other points of view to be aired. And, you know, what's wrong with having the other side of the story? It broke the monopoly of, you know, established elite media. There was once a time when, you know, three executives, and I'm exaggerating, of course, you know, ABC, NBC, and CBS decided what was news, and if they decided something was not news, then it was not news. Well, now suddenly you had this proliferation of other voices, which is a good thing. But somewhere along the line, of course, what happened was this morphed into an echo chamber, which became an alternative reality silo, which has empowered and emboldened some of the most outrageous and reckless voices. And I think the conservative movement really has not recovered from that. So at one time, something that seemed like it was empowering conservative voices, I think became one of the major forces that deranged the conservative movement.
Well, I thought the policy also in the Fairness Doctrine was for every kind of position or ideology, a partisan position, that there was going to be a balancing, and I mean that in a genuine way, not in false equivalent balancing, but that the other point of view would be expressed, and that went away so that the conservative measures that they were ready to move in with Rush Limbaugh and Fox following soon thereafter with their, do you not agree that the Fairness Doctrine had that element to it too, a balancing act?
Yes. Now Fox didn't go on the air until 1996. But yes, that's a lot of these things are much more recent than sometimes we realize. But you know, I mean, I guess you know, looking back on it, I don't really want the government regulating what people should be able to say and what people should be able to broadcast. I guess I this is where I come down in sort of a libertarian way.
Okay.
Let the more flowers bloom and blossom. The real impact of the Fairness Doctrine was not balance. The real impact of the Fairness Doctrine back then was actually that nobody ever talked about things. That if you were an AM station, you did not ever want to talk about a controversial issue because somebody might complain to the FCC, and then the FCC would come down and then would, you know, ask you to, you know, what kind of programming. So the reality in the real world was that broadcasters just kind of threw up their hands and said, let's put on another cooking show. Let's talk about the weather or, you know, child rearing or something. So it really was by the end of the 1980s, AM talk radio was pretty much a wasteland. I mean, I understand, you know, going back and forth, you look back at that as a pivotal moment that unleashed this whole wave. But I guess I'm not sure that more, you know, government speech police is ever going to be the answer to what's wrong with our dialogue.
So let's go on Wisconsin, the state politics. You had a ringside seat, an ample opportunity and access to this whole political process. I'd like for you to start around 2010 and go to the present. There were a lot of aspects going on. The Koch brothers were very involved, I'm going to posit, in getting Scott Walker elected, in getting a Republican state legislature in place to be able to create the congressional districts and the state districts. Would you comment on what was going on from 2010 forward to 2016 in Wisconsin only?
Sure. Well, now keep in mind that I'd been a fixture in Wisconsin media since about 1993.
That's when your show started, right?
When my radio show began, and you know, pretty much knew all of the players here.
Yes.
And you know, from the ground view, a couple of things. You have to remember what the environment was like in 2009 and 2010 nationally. That was a wave election for Republicans. In Wisconsin, it was a very dramatic wave election. You know, in before the 2010 election, Democrats controlled everything. They controlled the governorship. They controlled both houses of the legislature. They dominated the congressional delegation, and both United States senators were Democrats. After the 2010 election, they had none of those things. They lost a U.S. Senate seat that nobody saw coming. They lost both houses of the legislature. They lost the governorship. And the majority of the members of Congress were Republican. So what happened?
Yes.
I think what happened in Wisconsin was kind of a bellwether for what was happening around the country.
Exactly.
This was very much the Tea Party rebellion. I know that people outside Wisconsin talk about the role of the Koch brothers, and I think that's overstated. I mean, Americans for Prosperity was one of the players, but they were certainly only one of the players in Wisconsin. And in fact, I can remember when somebody from our sister television station came over to me and said that somebody had put out a statement about the role of the Koch brothers and what players they were, and I said, I don't know that they're that big a player here in Wisconsin.
Really?
We had a lot of big players in Wisconsin, but they were not the biggest player in Wisconsin. So the Republicans took control of everything, and I think you know a lot of it. They moved very, very quickly to move on collective bargaining rights. Of course, the reapportionment of the legislative districts is in front of the U.S. Supreme Court right now. And despite multiple elections, virtually everything that Republicans won in Wisconsin in 2010, they still have. And, you know, even after the recall elections, even after 2012 and 2016. But also I would point out that Wisconsin Republicans were among the very, very few groups who did not buy Trump or Trumpism, at least initially. When he came to Wisconsin during the Republican primaries, remember, he was beaten badly in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Because I think we recognized the clown car when it came into town and was probably one of the least friendly states that he encountered anywhere.
The Janesville congressional guy, though, could maybe make up all the difference in the sort of the run-up to the election, though. So there's ample servings to go around. Well, in your recent interviews, like with the New York Times Sunday Magazine, you said you thought that the Wisconsin was going to be a firewall, but it was a speed bump. But I think I think you've just said to us, it's that Wisconsin was a trial run for executing an amazing ground game that made it up in the margins where it really mattered. Well, one thing that puzzles me, and maybe you can shed light on your take here, is throughout this whole campaign, the zero-sum game was never challenged by the GOP opponents. It was always policies that were given, as we know, short shrift from previous elections. When policy came up, that there was no challenge to that zero sum. I think you and I agree that when you lift up lower income levels that you're lifting up everybody.
Well, by the way, I want to just mention something about Wisconsin, because I do think it's relevant in the current political situation. And I hope the progressives listen very carefully. Because I watched what happened in Wisconsin, and remember the siege of Wisconsin when hundreds of thousands of people came in?
Yes, you talk about that in the book.
At that point, I will tell you that I think that Scott Walker and the Republicans were losing the political debate. I don't think that the public necessarily supported those conservative policies. But what happened was that many of the protesters on the left overplayed their hand. Their tactics became the issue. They showed up at Special Olympics events and disrupted them. They picketed at the governor's house where his elderly parents lived. And by the end of that whole cycle, what happened was that people were reacting against the tactics rather than for the substance. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is because there's always the possibility that in the era of Trump, that the opponents will overplay their hand to the point that will spark a backlash. I will tell you that Steve Bannon and Donald Trump would like nothing more than for protesters to cross the lines, to make themselves the issue, to flip the script in that particular way. Because when Republicans won in Wisconsin, this was a state, by the way, at that point, which had been pretty solidly Democratic for a very long time, with some notable exceptions. But Democrats have lost one election after another, and not because the Republicans or conservatives have actually been brilliant. It's because I think the Democrats have engaged in mistakes. I've written a book because I think that Republicans and conservatives really need to look in the mirror, need to engage in some introspection. I would hope that folks on the left would do the same thing. As well, because we're at a crucial moment, and this is one of those tipping point moments where you don't want to get it wrong.
Well, Charlie Sykes, I want to posit, though, there was one shoe that didn't drop in your book, and that is Citizens United. And I think you and I would agree that the donor class is made up of more conservatives than progressives, and that could be every bit as consequential, I would posit even more consequential than mistakes that Democrats made.
No, this is an interesting question, and I would like to think more about this, to be quite honest, because I think one of the words that we don't use enough in American politics is oligarch. We talk about the Russian oligarchs. The reality is that American politics is now dominated by American oligarchs, billionaires who have outsized influence in American politics, and to a certain extent, and I say this as somebody that has seen a lot of this up close and personal,
right,
that it's even worse than you think it is, and that we need to confront this in some way. One of the things about 2016, though, which was a lesson that we shouldn't ignore, though, was that ultimately money was not as important as it used to be, because Donald Trump was not the most well-funded candidate. He was the most covered candidate by the news media, but he did not spend the kind of money that we would normally associate with a winner. So in part of it, in the new media ecosystem, political alignment, maybe money does not have quite the... Look, if money was the ultimate determining factor, Jeb Bush would have been the nominee, and he wasn't. In fact, he got almost nowhere despite raising hundreds of millions of dollars. So this is something that we need to step back and really ask. I don't deny that we have a problem. We have a serious oligarchy problem in this country. We also have a problem. I see in the paper this morning that another billionaire donor is thinking of running for the United States Senate out in Wyoming, as if we
Eric
don't
Prince
have
in,
enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. As if we don't have enough millionaire United States senators. This is not something that I think that we should should embrace, this notion that we will have a ruling class in Washington that is becoming more disconnected with the country than ever before. I mean, you look at Donald Trump's cabinet, and you're talking about mega millionaires and billionaires making decisions about the lives of the rest of us. There's something that does not add up there.
Well, I know that vocabulary has been used by the left, the oligarchs, a lot. And so that's part of the sort of intellectual honesty that I'm looking at the Venn diagram and seeing where I plot that. Well, I guess we're not going to get to cover everything, but there's one line, and maybe it's I read your galley proof, so I don't know if it made it into the final. But when you talked about, as far as I propose this progressive overplaying their hand, you talked about assorted hysterical tantrums. And so I'm thinking that you attributed to the left. And when you look at where we are now with what's going on, first that the U.S. government is scrubbing websites right and left, that FEMA is... That particular one, most recently, yes, is scrubbing what it's the disaster response is effectiveness is, and that you consider what's going on in North Korea and in Iran and everywhere. And there are, of course, lots of things that are brewing we don't even know about yet, but they're happening and they're not getting any sort of back-channel attention. Would you not see that those reactions from the press, would you not see as less hysterical tantrums than truly deeply understanding the consequences of November 8, 2016.
I understand your point completely. We are living in perilous times. There's no question about it on a daily basis. I mean, when you have the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee worrying that the President of the United States might be kicking us into World War III, this is not normal stuff. This requires a rather dramatic response. I think what I was referring to there would have been, the kinds of things that would make for YouTube videos, you know, whether it's, Antifa in the streets or something like that. It's like that this requires a very strong, powerful response. Don't get me wrong. And my reaction to everything you just mentioned is probably as strong as yours in terms of absolute outrage, the desire not to normalize any of this. But again, understand that certain things will play into Donald Trump's hands. Donald Trump wants to orchestrate. He's certainly not the first president to play divisive politics, but he's the first president to play it so nakedly. You know, I think it's pretty obvious with what he's doing with the NFL and other issues. This is a president that wants to create symbolic divisions in this country and will exploit dissent, will exploit protests, will exploit any overreach for his benefit. Now, that doesn't mean that we do not take this very seriously, because I actually believe that the kinds of things that you were describing pose an existential threat,
yes,
to our democracy, and perhaps just a period an existential threat when you're talking about nuclear war. So I'm not suggesting that we don't have a strong reaction. But again, it's important to make sure that our reaction is effective and gets us where we want to be.
So I'm going to give you an opportunity. This is the last question we have.
Sure.
What is the writing on the wall you're observing, Charlie Sykes, that you've not had the opportunity to express? I want Ask a Leader have this moment with you.
Well, I am by nature an optimist. I have a real sense of the resiliency and greatness of this country, but I'm worried. I don't see any of these things getting better in the near term.
Mm-hmm.
I see the country dominated by political vandals at this point, including the man who's sitting in the Oval Office. So what I'm hoping is that Americans realize that our institutions and our democratic values are more fragile than I think that we have thought in the past, and that we need to take this moment with a great deal of seriousness. I think that in terms of the media, everything bad that is happening is likely to get worse until we come to grips with the reality, what we are learning about it. So the writing on the wall is that I wish there was more courage. I wish there was more principle. I wish there was less complacency, but we're not there yet.
Well, Charles Sykes, it's been a real pleasure. You took some time off of your busy radio show, your book tour with us. Thank you for joining us today on Ask a Leader. It's been a real joy.
It's been a real pleasure for me, too.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back after a short station break, and Shahir Masri will be joining us. Charles Sykes is my guest. on about his new book, How the Right Lost His Mind, published by St. Martin's Press. Be right back. Tina Raymond, and the track was Lift Every Voice and Sing. So we're going to lift another voice carrying the climate change theme, because that isn't going away. Didn't get to bring that up with Charlie Sykes, but we get to do that now with my second guest. Thanks for joining us. Welcome back to Ask a Leader. Dr. Shahir Masri is climate scientist and blogger, returning to finish what we started a couple of weeks ago about climate science. Earth, that's spelled E-A-A-R-T-H, is an essential new notion that Bill McKibben respectfully submits. And we're going to talk also about the spike in post-disaster payouts. That's a big deal, folks. It's a federal, state, and local budget expended on disaster assistance, recovery, and rebuilding, and those payouts are huge. And then finally, maybe if we have a little bit of time left, the ubiquitous plastic stuff. Shahir specializes in air pollution exposure assessment epidemiology at UCI, focusing on exposure assessment relating to particulate matter and other ambient air pollutants. I think we might have had some fallout 2 weeks ago. We've got even more fallout now with the local Anaheim Hills fire. Among other elaborate models, he's developed and applied a novel satellite-based air pollution exposure model to estimate air pollution exposure among U.S. military personnel deployed in Southwest Asia and Afghanistan. He's also an adjunct faculty member at the Schmidt College of Science and Technology at Chapman University. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, Shahir Masri.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to race right through this. Since you were last on, we've had another hurricane, that's Nat, make landfall along the Alabama coast, and we've got at least four wildfires burning in California alone, one down the freeway from here. Let's talk first, though, about what the tireless Bill McKibben has been posting of recent from his book, Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H.
Yeah, so I think that a lot of what Bill McKibben emphasizes in his book actually comes right down to what we're experiencing now. So last time we talked 2 weeks ago, we had a fire here in Orange County. Now here we are again today, an even worse fire, taking over six homes already. Also, back when we had talked, I had just written an op-ed piece called Hurricanes and the Climate is the Worst Yet to Come. In the Hill. And we saw within a week of that the answer to that question was already answered. So Hurricane Maria, which came after Irma and Harvey, landed as a Category 5 hurricane in the island of Dominica. And we know what happened thereafter in Puerto Rico. My concern...
Well, we don't know all that happened.
With so much
of that infrastructure wiped out.
Right, yeah. We can only guess as to how worse this is going to become as time goes on. My concern is that what we're seeing now, these extreme weather events, hurricanes, floods, wildfires, are just the tip of the iceberg and sort of indicative of what is yet to come. And that's exactly what Bill McKibben emphasizes, titling his book Earth, spelt with double A's, that we are shifting away from the Earth that we've all come to sort of know in our own lives, but also that humans have actually evolved with and adapted with. The climate is now shifting, that we should be... sort of our expectations should be getting away from what we've come to know. That is, we are living now in a new earth with a new climate, and we should almost call it a different earth. And that's what he's emphasizing. And I mean, I can go through some stats that sort of perhaps give some insight as to what this earth might look like. Sure. So going back just a decade, 2007, we saw 20% less Arctic ice than had ever been recorded. If you compare that to the Apollo mission back in 1968, that's 40% less global ice cover than they had seen when they looked back down on Earth. As you know, the Northwest Passage is now open to shipping. Previously, that was all covered in ice. In terms of lightning strikes, which, as we know, give rise to fires, we saw in 2008 40% more thunderheads over the oceans. In one day in June in 2008, there were 1,700 wildfires in California started by lightning. One day in June, it burned over 1 million acres.
Does that make your head explode?
Yeah, and we're witnessing it right now today. We know based on the science that with every degree increase in Fahrenheit temperature, we can expect about a 6% increase in lightning. When you combine that with a 78-day longer fire season here in California compared to back about 50 years ago, that suggests a lot of room for concern, and that is a bit of what we might be able to expect moving forward in this new Earth, as Bill McKibben calls it.
And with the weather conditions, with the increased temperature, the lowering of humidity makes all those factors even more devastating.
Right. So when the Santa Anas come blowing through these extreme dry, warm winds, I mean, that is really a perfect storm combined with the fact that we haven't had rain here for so long. October with those Santa Ana winds and that sort of the end of that long dry period, you really have a perfect mix for fires. And that's exactly what we're seeing. And up in Northern California, where we saw many, many, many homes lost and 10 lives or so, they've got an even worse situation going on.
And then there's one more, the drought in Australia.
You actually put the words into my mouth. So Australia is, back in 2008 or so, about half the country was in drought. Actually, the government was, Australian government was warning that these, what are typically one in every 25-year dry spells and hot spells should now be expected to occur about every 1 to 2 years. What's happened in Australia, unfortunately, climatically, is the valuable water that is usually brought in with the winds has actually been, as those winds have shifted, that water is now dropping over open ocean and doing no good to the people and the ecosystem in Australia. As we call them droughts, they're actually shifting or pushing to sort of avoid use of the term drought because drought suggests that there is an end in sight. And as the climate shifts, many people in Australia are becoming aware that there is not necessarily an end in sight.
What is the word then? Is there one, or we got to work on with phenomenologists to come up with the word?
Yeah, I mean,
or
I think
it's climate change, but it's, there's got to be one word.
Yeah.
So the people with puppets can keep using that without any lapse here.
Right. Very, 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 very scary, actually, that this is becoming a new norm for agriculture, for wildfires. I mean, they know wildfires very well. I mean, fires have ripped across Australia, as well as they're a very drought-prone area, especially recently. I mean, here in the United States, of course, we know that in California we've had our share of droughts, but just look at the whole country. There are twice as many falling rivers as there are rising rivers. So that also suggests a sort of new environment that we're not really used to.
For those of you who've just joined us, racing through the climate pointers and resuming what we talked about 2 weeks ago is Tahir Masri, an environmental health scientist at UCI, where he conducts research on air pollution and related human health impacts. I know this is unfair to race you through all this. The spike in poster disaster payouts, there's a fiscal issue there, and I don't know, there's probably winners and losers in these kinds of payouts too. How does that spike look as we plot it? Is it's an exponential payout now on all levels of government? Tell us about what you know there.
Well, I could tell you a little bit about what I know about the cost of these disasters and the economics that play into reparation after these disasters take place, that is hurricanes, droughts, wildfires. In 2016, so just last year, there were about 15 $1 billion or more, and I'm talking here about cost of reparation, $1 billion or more natural disaster-related events. This is in the United States. If you compare that to the average between 1980 and 2006, so the average between that entire time period, so about 35 years, was about 5.5 of these events. You look at the average over just the last 5 years, twofold increase, about 10.5 of these $1 billion or more events. Now, I say $1 billion, but the key is or more. And in 2016, the total cost was $46 billion.
That's last year.
That's last year. Billion with a B. $46 billion spent on these disasters. I mean, who knows what 2017 is going to amount to, but all signs point to not so good.
And you know what? We were talking about existential disasters with the current administration. And if we're seeing the U.S. government scrubbing websites we're going to be missing some really important data to understand what's going on with the climate change reparations.
Absolutely. When you say scrubbing websites, I used to get on the EPA website quite a bit. I do so a little bit less because it's a little harder to find climate change related information.
That's a sophisticated scientist having difficulty. So it's just...
you shouldn't have to hunt to find something, information on an issue that is so pressing. So that climate change phrase is now removed from the front page of the EPA. It really should be on the front page of every website. But so that's discouraging. And, you know, if you're going to make it that difficult, you can assume that you're just sending a message to the population that this isn't something that's important or anything that you should focus on or know about.
Right, because the null set doesn't tell you that it is important or isn't important. It's just illiteracy that it begets.
Exactly. And, you know, Scott Pruitt, head of the EPA, you know, his sort of stance on climate change, he's taken a bit of a negligent stance on climate change with respect to really all aspects of climate change and just suggesting that it's not a big deal or it's not happening. And for the head of the Environmental Protection Agency to be taking that stance, that's extremely disconcerting.
It is. I don't know how any of us are getting any sleep anymore. The payouts that you're talking about, are your sources mainly covering the federal level, or is it a total for all that? Because I think it's important because the local and state treasuries are also considered, because we're all paying into that, and money out of those funds, money that's not available for other things that we all need. And name the category.
Right. I mean, that's a good point. And I'm not sure if the $46 billion is strictly federal assistance or if that was also at a local level. But regardless, whether it's local or federal, that is going to be taxpayer money, whether it's, you know, you're in and around the area or if you're a federal taxpayer, that's still going to be coming out of your pocket. And we can definitely presume that a fair fraction of that is federal funding.
So what are your sources for tracking these payouts? So we can try it, maybe, if we're not going to find it on the U.S. government websites.
So you'll find a lot of this stuff actually on the U.S. government website. It's mostly the EPA website that I was referring to that sort of is missing, is really downplaying the importance of climate change, at least on its front page. You can still find a lot of this stuff if
Where?
You dig around. Well, the National Oceanographic and NOAA. Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, they're a great source for climate-related information and natural disaster-related information. I forget if it's NOAA that actually lists this $46 billion, and they actually have all of the natural disaster events listed. I think it could be NOAA, and I can't remember exactly.
Well, you have some time left to cover the topic of plastics. There's an enormous uptick of the amount of plastic that is being... So, folks, we're not talking about the recycling. We're talking about the manufacture, the distribution, and the waste stream, the solid waste management and recycling. So plastic is sort of like, really, it's kicked the door down within the last few years compared to our consumption over the previous century.
That's true. There's a phrase that I'll quote, plastics like diamonds are forever, right? So plastics don't biodegrade. In fact, every single plastic, I mean, think about this, every plastic that has ever been manufactured on this planet still exists somewhere today, unless it's been burned.
And only so many of those are sweaters and little blankies.
Right. And even, you know, those products, they're still plastic polymers. So you're still
That's
not
big.
Getting out of the, yeah, you're not sort of overcoming the biodegradation hurdle. So whether it's a sweater or it's just sitting in a landfill or it's been made into a wetsuit or something, those plastics still exist somewhere and they're not going to biodegrade, unfortunately. You mentioned there's been an uptick. Yeah, to be specific, it's been about a 5% increase per year of plastic production over about the last 20 years. So definitely a growing problem. These plastics oftentimes don't get into the recycling bin, as you
Most
mentioned.
Most of them. More don't get into than do. So like only, is it like 30%, do I understand?
It's somewhere between 10 and 30%. Yes.
Oh, I mean, 30 is high. So that's a lot of plastic.
It's a lot of plastic.
Accumulating where...
Yeah, I mean, that
doesn't just sit.
It doesn't just sit. In fact, we have these big circulating ocean gyres. Have you heard? I mean, if you heard of the Pacific garbage patch. It's sort of a phrase that came.
And it's growing.
It's growing. You know, an area they say that twice the size of Texas out in the middle of the Pacific. Now, this doesn't mean it looks like a landfill out there, but there's a concentration of garbage, mostly plastic garbage. In fact, marine litter by mass is about 60 to 80% is plastic. So it's hanging around in the ocean, not just the Pacific, but all around and accumulating on islands. It's affecting lots of wildlife, from monk seals, which up in Hawaii are already endangered, to albatross. When they find dead albatross, either on land or what have you, and they dissect them, they find about 50 to 100% of these marine birds have plastic in their
That's
stomachs.
Just one species. I mean, we crack open everyone, they're going to see an enormous amount of that plastic washing up. So I just feel like we need to put a frown, not a sticker, a frown billboard over those pallets of full of all these plastic water bottles that people think it's a no big deal. And with various leading edge conferences that are shoving plastic water bottles out there without the reusable ones being, you know, people getting brownie stickers for doing the right thing.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think it's one important thing for listeners to take home is that contrary to what might be popular belief, plastic water bottles do not give you cleaner water. So in America especially, we have very clean tap water. And in fact, it's more regulated than the water bottle industry. So tap water is regulated by the EPA. They're doing testing every single day to ensure that tap water is clean and that it's free of bacteria and contaminants. The FDA, which regulates bottled water, they're checking products about once per week. And in fact, a lot of bottled water removes chlorine, and chlorine, it turns out, is what keeps bacterial concentrations low. So you're actually, in some water bottles, you're seeing a higher bacterial count than you are in the municipal water system. So important to take home the message that bottled water is not only a nuisance to the ecosystem, but it's also not a healthier option unless you're in a developing country and there's some sort of issue with getting clean water from the tap. But outside of that, bottled water is not the way to go.
Well,
it's more expensive.
And it's more expensive. And I remember when Susan Frankel she published her book, and it was in 2011, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. And she'll go into even deeper detail about the kind of tailings from plastic, any product that nobody's really paying attention to except for really rigorous journalists and scientists that are keeping track of that. So this plastic waste stream and the hazards are, it must be maddening for scientists who really know what's going on.
Right. I mean, you can see it if you just go down to the beach. You'll see these plastic, what they call nurdles. They're these little tiny, smaller than a pea-sized plastic. And those are from the plastics industry. So
right.
Those go into the molding process when they melt them down and make plastics. And you literally see those all over the sand.
Well, Shahir, I know you've got a standing invitation to bring back more about climate science to us on this show today. Thanks for coming all the way down and joining me in studio.
Well, thanks so much. Always a pleasure to be on.
Okay. I have some announcements, folks. Hats off to the Orange County Climate Action Affiliates for hosting a massive forum of congressional candidates Sunday night at the Irvine Branch Water District. None of us will be able to recall when this many candidates would appear 8 months before the primary. You know what this means. If this many candidates show up now, we all have to show up at the voting booth in June. I'll be interviewing them all in the spring 2018 before the primary. Governor Brown signed Assembly Bill 249, the California Disclose Act. Now the follow-up is going to be continuing that momentum, starting with another bill, SB 651, the Petition Disclosure Act. Sunlight, as they say, is the best disinfectant in political processes. So that disclosure is an important measure. I can't resist some pithy lines of the day after the holiday yesterday, observing various Columbus and indigenous demographics, we'll say. I heard this pithy line from Kevin Gover, director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian. He quoted a friend of his, but without attributing exactly who the source was. The quote is, "Heritage is history with all the bad stuff taken out. And then Kevin Gover went on to mention, as far as Columbus Day commemoration of a famous Italian, the Italian-American story is quite a remarkable one. In a big way, they chose the wrong guy to be the symbol of the Italian-American heritage, end of quote. As a descendant of some pretty bigoted Sicilians, I say bravo, Mr. Gover. Later today in Orange County at the Planned Parenthood Forum, Dr. Willie Parker is a distinguished guest, and it'll be a most illustrious presentation to hear from him today. Well, that was my wrap. Next week, documentary filmmaker Angelo Bacca will return to the show on the topic of food sovereignty. And Patrick Michaels, reporter with Reveal, Center for Investigative Reporting, has a definitive account of Orange County's fraught history with immigrants. Talk with you next week. Thank you for listening, everyone.